Oops. Thanks, David. That was an interesting introduction.
Yeah.
Anyway, and it really has been a delight to get to spend a week in this amazing place, and for me to meet almost an entirely new group of people, you not included. You're also a new group for me, and I'm really glad to get to give a talk that's very much about the experiments that we're doing in the lab and how we're thinking about bacteria. And so thank you and my host Boris for having me here. So, okay, to get going, I only have one goal for this seminar, and that's to try to convince you that bacteria can talk to each other. Well, I know, but that's not my, but that, this is like a theory place. They're not good at it. If you want that, you gotta go to MIT. They do technology. Okay, thank you. Okay, so my only goal tonight is to, can you hear me? Yeah. Right, it's a, I ne- no one has trouble hearing me, as you got a little clue about. Okay, so I want to try to convince you that bacteria can talk to each other. And then the secondary goal that I have is to try to convince you that they're multilingual. And then sort of my third thing is to try to show you that that's actually important for the evolution of life on this earth, and also important, hopefully, for going forward in medicine. And so, since I know you guys have all different backgrounds, before I start on that, I want to make sure that we all know what bacteria are, because I'll be talking about these critters for the entire evening. So this is a cartoon of a typical bacterium, like an E. coli, that would live in your digestive system, in your gut. And bacteria are the oldest organisms on the earth. They are 4 billion years old, so they've been here for quite a while. And they all look rather like this, which is that they're single cells, they're microscopic, so you've never actually seen one. You need a microscope to see them. And they're covered in a membrane, which you can think of like their skin. And so that keeps the outside out and the inside in. And then inside the single cells is the cytoplasm. It's sort of the goop that all the biomolecules slosh around in, much like on the insides of our cells as well. So all the things that keep them alive. And then what's special about bacteria is that they only have one piece of DNA. So they have one chromosome. And so they only have a few thousand genes. And so they're very primitive looking, and genetically they're primitive as well. They're pretty stripped down. And if you actually just sort of watch bacteria, what they seem to do for a living is to consume nutrients from their environment. They grow to twice their size. They cut themselves down in the middle, and one cell becomes two, and so on and so on and so on. So kind of a mundane, boring life. And so we've known about these guys for 400 years, and they've always been considered to be these primitive asocial organisms that when they divided in half, each sister cell has no knowledge, if you will, of its sibling. They were just too primitive to be able to know each other was there, so they each would just go out and do their individual thing with no knowledge, if you will, of the other bacteria there. But of course, if you think about bacteria, they have us on our knees, right? They do all these terrible things that they get pressed for, and they also do all kinds of miraculous things on this earth that we never hear about, that in fact are vital for keeping us alive and keeping the earth going. And the question that my gang had was whether they're doing bad things or good things, how can it be that they can do anything at all, right? They are incredibly successful. They make up 50% of all the biomass on this earth. So I believe they know what they're doing. And the question is, how do these little bitty guys get any bang for their buck? And so that's where we're going tonight. I'm going to try to show you that they talk to each other and they act in groups. But just in case that's not enough to get you interested, I want to tell you about your relationship with bacteria. So this is basically the Bonnie Bassler way of viewing the world. This is my idea of a human being. And so what I did here is to make this man, this human, out of all of these circles. And each of those circles represents some number of cells. So we know how many cells are in the human body. There's about a trillion cells. So that's how many cells it takes you to give you all your physical features and then to give you all the features that make you alive. Well, it turns out that at any moment in your life, you have 10 times more bacterial cells than human cells in you or on you. And so we're at a place that likes to do math. And so if you like this metric, you're only 10% human. You're really 90% bacteria. But of course, you know, you guys come to science talks, which is odd, on, you know, weeknights, so you guys are smart, and you know it's not the cells that matter, it's the DNA. So now I've made the man again out of the A's, G's, T's, and C's. Those are the nucleotides that make up the double helix of the DNA, so your genetic information. And of course, we know how many genes humans have because we have the human genome sequenced. There's about 30,000 genes that give us all of our features and that make us live. Well, it turns out if you think about the bacteria, since each of these species of bacteria gives its own set of genes, it turns out you have 100 times more bacterial genes than human genes in you or on you every moment of your life. So no matter which of these you like, at best you're 10% human, probably you're only 1% human. The other 99% is bacterial. And these bacteria are not just living as passive writers. What we understand now is that without them, we would be dead. So the first thing is that they cover your body in what's called a biofilm. And it's like an invisible body armor that keeps environmental insults and invading microbes from harming you. They also supply all kinds of genes that we don't have in our repertoire of these 30,000 genes. So you guys know they help you digest your food. They make your vitamins. They actually educate your immune system and tell your immune system right after you're born which bacteria are good and which bacteria are bad. So they do all of these things every minute of our life, but we never think about them, you know, in that way. First, because we can't see them, and also because it's just the way that we live, and we sort of expect them to play this role. But now we understand that most of the genetics and cell biology going on comes from your personal microflora. So, but of course, I don't want to be a Pollyanna, right? We have all of these microbes that on this earth that have no business being in us or on us, and so I put a few of the ones that you've probably read about in the newspaper. These are just pictures of them taken under a microscope, right? And so there's all these bacteria that when they are in you or on you can make you incredibly sick or can actually kill you. And so again, the question that my lab had was whether they're doing all these good things for us or whether they're on us and they're doing bad things, how can it be that they can actually have these amazing effects? And so what I want to tell you is how that works, and what I thought I would do is to give you sort of a historical view of how we got into this idea that bacteria act in groups. And it actually all started with a ridiculous bacterium that lives in the ocean named Vibrio fischeri. And a colleague of mine, Woody Hastings, about 40 years ago, noticed that this bacterium has this special property that it's bioluminescent. So it makes light like fireflies make light, except that it's blue. But what he noticed is that the bacteria only made light when they were at high cell number. So if the bacteria were alone, they made no light, but if they grew to a certain number, they all turned on light together. And so what we wondered is how can a bacterium distinguish times when it's alone and times when it's together and then do something, in this case, turn on light. And so what we found out is that the way it happens is that the bacteria tell each other they're there by talking with a chemical language. So this is supposed to be my cartoon of a bacterium. When the bacteria are alone, they don't want to make light, but what they do is they make and secrete small molecules that you can think of like hormones. We call these autoinducers. So they make these molecules and they release them into the environment. And if the bacteria are alone, you know, small cell in a big world, the molecules just float away. The bacteria can't perceive them, so they make no light. But when the cells grow and divide and grow and divide, since everybody is participating in making and releasing these molecules, the amount of the molecule in the vicinity increases in proportion to cell number. And when the molecule hits a certain amount, the bacteria detect that that molecule is there, and they use that as a proxy for cell number. They say, oh, I have a lot of neighbors, and everybody turns on light in unison. So the entire group of bacteria make bioluminescence. And so it's actually very simple. They actually use this molecule as a word to tell each other to do something. And so they're making light, and what I thought I would tell you next, before I get into the molecular biology of this, is what's the real biology behind this bacterium. And so this bacterium lives a wonderful life as a symbiont in an animal that's called the Hawaiian bobtail squid. So they live in a one-to-one relationship. There's the squid, and then the only bacterium is this Vibrio fischeri. So first, the squid's perspective. So this is the Hawaiian bobtail squid. It's about this big, full grown, and we have it in an aquarium here with no sand. This is a nocturnal animal, so it looks very uncoordinated and uncomfortable because it's not used to being out in the light. What it does is it sleeps during the day just a couple inches under the sediment. So now we've provided the squid what it's used to seeing, which is the seafloor, and there you just saw it camouflage itself by changing color. And so it sleeps under the sand in order to avoid predators during the day. And so it's pretty serious about this. And she's thorough. Okay, so that's a really good strategy. And if I hadn't shown you that squid, of course, you wouldn't know where it is in that tank. There are actually many squid in this tank buried just a couple inches there under the sediments. And so, of course, this is what they really do in the ocean. And this is a fantastic strategy to avoid predators during the day. But the issue for this squid is that at night they have to come out to hunt because they also need to eat. And so the problem is that this squid lives literally just off the coast of Hawaii, so in sort of knee-deep, shallow water. And when the squid comes out at night, since the water is so shallow, the starlight or moonlight can penetrate the depth of the water that the squid lives in. So when it was swimming around, it would make a shadow. And then predators could see its shadow, calculate its trajectory, and eat it. So what this squid has done for its nighttime life is to evolve this one-to-one symbiosis with Vibrio fischeri. So this little squid, now you're looking at the squid, it's been turned on its back. And I hope what you can see are two lobes of a specialized light organ that are under the mantle or the body of the squid. And in that light organ is this bacterium, Vibrio fischeri, at something like 10 to the 12th cells per mil. So the bacteria are jam-packed in there. They're making that molecule I told you about. And of course, since they're trapped in here as opposed to in the ocean, the molecule builds up and the bacteria make light. And then what the squid does is it has detectors on its back that it can sense how much starlight or moonlight it's hitting its back. And then it opens and closes a shutter, which is just its ink sac, over this light organ. So the amount of light coming out of the bottom, which is made by the bacteria, exactly matches how much light hits the squid's back. So the squid actually uses the light from the bacterium to counter-illuminate itself and to avoid making a shadow. So it's sort of like the stealth bomber of the ocean, right? It cloaks itself in this invisible device by matching the starlight to the light from the bacteria. And so that's how this squid manages through its life. But there's actually one more special feature of this, is that if you think about what I've told you so far, these bacteria are in there at like 10 to the 12th per mil, that molecule's there, they're making a lot of light. The squid can't maintain that indefinitely. And so what happens is every morning when the squid goes back to sleep, it buries itself in the sand, and then it's got a pump that's attached to its circadian rhythm. And so when the sun comes up, the squid pumps out 95% of the bacteria. And so now the bacteria are dilute, and that little molecule is gone. But of course, the squid doesn't care because it's asleep in the sand. And then as the day goes by, the bacteria grow and divide and grow and divide. The molecule builds up, gets trapped in there, and at night, the bacteria turn the light on exactly when the squid needs it. Right? And so it's a beautiful symbiosis. The squid gets this protection, and this bacterium gets food. This light organ is loaded with sugars and all kinds of goodies. It's a much richer, happy, fatter life. You can make a lot more babies, and progeny, in that squid than fending for yourself free living. Okay, so the reason to tell you that story is the obvious cheap theatrics that it's 8 o'clock at night. But also, you know, because this is the first one of these bacteria that we realized could do these group behaviors. And the reason that this got discovered was because most things bacteria do are invisible. I mean, the bacteria themselves are invisible. But with this guy, you could just see it with your eyes, it turning on and off light with these in these groups. And so that led us into this idea to wonder how that could happen. And so what we did was to bring molecular biology to the table and start picking apart what is the actual mechanism that this bacterium uses to talk to each other. And so again, this is my cell, right? And what we realized is that the bacterium has an enzyme that makes that molecule, the hormone, the autoinducer, which is the red triangle. And that diffuses out of the cells and then, of course, increases with cell number. And then sitting on the cell surface is a receptor, very much like the hormone receptors that sit on the surfaces of your cells. And they have a little slot in the top of it that this molecule can fit into. And so when the molecule accumulates, it can find that receptor, bind it, and then that sends information into the cell to tell the bacterium to turn on light. And so it's really simple the way it works. The more cells there are, the more of this molecule there is. At a certain amount, the receptor locks in into it, and all the cells turn on light. And the reason that that's interesting and why I'm invited here is because although this was originally found in this symbiont, Vibrio fischeri, in fact, we now have hundreds and hundreds of examples of bacteria that have similar circuits. So now what we think is that all bacteria must be able to tell when they're alone and to tell when they're in the groups, and the way they do it is with this chemical communication. So we've found hundreds of examples of bacteria that make molecules. They all have partner receptors, and then what the bacteria turn on on is different depending on who the bacterium is, right? And so now we have a fancy name for this. We call it quorum sensing. The bacteria vote with these chemical votes, the vote gets counted, and the group acts. And so that's how it works. And we also now know a lot about what these molecules are. So in my cartoons, these were drawn as triangles, but in fact, a number of these have been studied and we know the structures of them. So of course, the first one that got figured out was the Vibrio fischeri signal. But when we started looking in lots of other bacteria, what we realized was that all of the words, or the molecules, if you will, are related. So this is just a little smattering of different quorum sensing bacteria. These are different species of bacteria. And each of these molecules is the word that that bacterium talks with. And so what I hope you can see is that the left-hand part of the molecules are identical, but the right-hand parts are a little bit different in every single species of bacteria. And what that does, these are just carbons, is to confer exquisite species specificities to each of these languages. So each of these molecules fits like a lock and key in its partner receptor, but no other. Right? And so what I mean by that is if I take the Vibrio fischeri molecule and put it on Agrobacterium, nothing happens. Likewise, the Agrobacterium molecule has no effect on Vibrio fischeri. So what we think then is that these molecules allow intra-species communication. These are private, secret conversations that bacteria carry out with their siblings so that they can decide when to do things. So those are the molecules. We also know a lot about the behaviors in all these hundreds of species of bacteria. So I told you in excruciating detail how it works for Vibrio fischeri and bioluminescence, but of course most bacteria aren't bioluminescent. And so what we're learning is that in many clinically relevant cases, what bacteria do with quorum sensing is to turn on adhesins that allow them to make a biofilm, these films that are like on your teeth, for example, in the morning, you know, on your skin, inside you when you are in a catheter. They make biofilms and then they secrete virulence factors. And if you think about this from the bacterium's point of view, this is a fabulous strategy. If a bacterium is ever going to give something away, it's never going to get its own back. And so what we understand now is that quorum sensing is about when these bacteria give things away, and it's only when the collective does it together that these tasks become successful. And so I'll just give you a couple examples. Pseudomonas aeruginosa, this is an opportunistic human pathogen. It's just a bacterium that lives in the dirt. You and I encounter it every single day of our lives. It's harmless to us. But if you have cystic fibrosis, you will die of a Pseudomonas aeruginosa infection. And the reason is because people who have CF have a genetic mutation that makes it so they can't clear their lungs. You and I breathe in all kinds of gunk, and then we have ways to keep our lungs sterile. People who have CF can't do that. And so they always have an infection in their lungs with all kinds of bacteria. But what happens is typically when a kid is in his or her teens, for reasons that we don't understand, they become permanently colonized with Pseudomonas aeruginosa, and that's what kills them. And the reason is because the bacterium has quorum sensing. So what it does is it makes a biofilm on the lung tissue, it covers itself with this goop that makes it impervious to antibiotics, and then as a collective, they all start secreting these toxins and proteases and enzymes that chew up the person's lung tissue. And so when you think about it from the human perspective, of course, it's a terrible disease. But again, when you think about it from the bacterium's perspective, it's really smart. Your immune system evolved to see invading bacteria and get rid of them. And so the last thing a bacterium wants to do is to release some toxin, because these are red flags for the immune system. So the better strategy is to wait, count yourselves with these small molecules, recognize when you have the right number that if you all launch the attack in unison, you'll be able to overcome a huge host. And so now we have, I don't know, dozens or hundreds of clinical pathogens that we know are avirulent if you make them so they can't talk or they can't hear. I put this one on here just because you have seen this one. This is called Erwinia. It's the one that makes your lettuce turn gudgy in the refrigerator. You know how the leaves, right? So it's a plant pathogen. It's got the same strategy as Pseudomonas. It's trying to infect a lettuce leaf or a potato. And so it gets there. They all release these toxins, and it makes a wound. So just like what I told you for Pseudomonas, but for a plant. But then the more insidious part of this is that simultaneously to releasing these virulence factors, this guy also releases a whole raft of antibiotics that it has immunity to. So it kills off all the competitor bacteria that would love to come in and take advantage of that wound, right? And so this list goes on and on and on, but you get the idea. It's always where you're going to give something away and you need a lot of it, and then it works. So that's quorum sensing. So we started to understand that bacteria can talk to each other, but then, if you'll remember the beginning of my talk, most bacteria don't get to live in this beautiful, pristine Vibrio fischeri life, you know, one-on-one with that squid. Most bacteria live like this. This is your skin. So this is a picture of your elbow taken under a microscope, and of course it's covered in a bacterial biofilm. It should be. But what you need to understand is that every one of these different shapes and sizes is a different species of bacteria, right? And so they're all living in this consortium. And so the question that we started to wonder about once we got where I told you is that if these bacteria are really trying to count each other, and these are these private conversations, it doesn't do you very much good to only count your siblings. There has to be a way to take a census of everybody else there, else you're not really counting, right? And so we wondered, couldn't it be more sophisticated than these simple single species conversations? And so what we decided to do to explore that was to study a cousin of Vibrio fischeri. So there was another bacterium that we knew about named Vibrio harveyi. So this is a bioluminescent marine bacterium that lives in the ocean. And it's very closely related to Vibrio fischeri, but it lives a different lifestyle. It lives free living in the ocean. It doesn't have a symbiotic host. And so what I'm actually showing you here, I wanted to put this slide in so you'd understand what we do in our lab. So this is a person from my lab holding a flask of this Vibrio harveyi bacteria. And so to take this picture, all we did was turn the lights off in the room, and we took the picture from the light that the bacteria make, right? So we're not doing anything to them. This is simply naturally produced bioluminescence. And in my lab, we're geneticists, so we like to make mutants and figure out what's wrong with them. And so what was so fantastic about Vibrio fischeri and also Vibrio harveyi is we could just make mutants, plate them out on petri plates, turn the lights off in the room, and look for bacteria that were glowing when they should be or not glowing when they should be. And just by picking those out, we found the components I told you about and then also the Vibrio harveyi system. And so when we started studying this free-living bacterium, we found that indeed it had a quorum sensing system. So it had an enzyme that made a molecule, and I've already shown it to you, and its partner receptor, which was for intra-species communication. But what we found out was that there was actually another system. So we found there was a second enzyme that made a second molecule. It also had a receptor, and then all of that information came into the cell to tell the cell to turn on light and hundreds of other genes that we're not measuring. You know, we're measuring light, but all these bacteria turn on lots of different genes in response to these chemicals. And so when we saw that, we thought, well, what the heck is the point of having two systems, right? If these two molecules don't encode different pieces of information, having two systems isn't better than having one. And so we wanted to do an experiment to think about that. And so what we did was to ask, well, where do we find these molecules? So we made a mutant in Vibrio harveyi that was missing the genes for the second system. So we just deleted those genes. So this bacterium turns on light if you give the first signal, what I'll call autoinducer 1. We made the reciprocal mutant. We made a mutant that was missing that system. And so now light only turns on if you provide autoinducer 2. And then remember, these molecules are on the outside of the cells, so we could just collect up every bacterium we could get our hands on, take the stuff they had lived in, and squirt it on these two mutants that we made. And what we found was that there was never a bacterium that made a molecule that turned on light through this system. And that should make sense to you. This is the intra-species private Vibrio harveyi language. But every bacterium that we tested made a molecule that turned on light through this system. And so our interpretation of that result is that these are two different languages. The first one is for intra-species communication. It's the Vibrio harveyi language. But the second molecule seemed to be made broadly in the bacterial environment. So we thought maybe this is the language of inter-species communication. This is how bacteria speak across species. And so to get evidence for that, we cloned the gene that was involved in making this molecule, and we sequenced it. And you guys know there's all these genome sequences, like the human genome. There's thousands of bacterial genomes out there, right? And so you can take your favorite gene, put it into the database, and ask who else has it. And sure enough, everybody had, all these bacteria had it. So we named that gene, so this is the enzyme that makes the second signal. We named that enzyme LuxS, and this is just a collection of some of the bacteria that have a highly conserved LuxS gene, and they all make that molecule. I don't know who you want to know on this slide. Let's see, if you live in Princeton, we care about anthrax because that gets put in the mailboxes. Let's see, this is bad breath. Whatever, gangrene, mono, if you have teenagers, right? You know, staph, strep, enterococcus, cholera, bubonic plague, they're all there. Okay, so we started to think, well, now wait a minute, you know, if it's true that this molecule is involved in virulence, the way I told you about these autoinducer ones, maybe now we can really start thinking about different strategies for manipulating these molecules to control pathogenicity in really clinically relevant pathogens that are in both the first world and the underdeveloped world. So the next thing we had to do was to get, it was clear all these bacteria were making it. The question is, what are they doing with it? I mean, E. coli 0157 is not turning on bioluminescence. You know, it doesn't have bioluminescence. So what do they do? And so we and lots of other scientists started to ask, what are the traits that are controlled by this molecule? And sure enough, in every case that's been studied, these bacteria turn on biofilm formation, which is the first step in pathogenicity, and then the secretion of all kinds of different virulence products. Right? And I want to say, I think that this list is a little skewed. You know, in my field, we study pathogens, right? These bacteria and other bacteria that are good bacteria also have autoinducer 2 and do lots of good things with it as well. It's just that this is the slant that the field has taken because we think about these pathogens a lot. So it seemed like now we had these two molecules and that this one was generic and that maybe it's involved in virulence. And so the next thing we did was ask, well, what is this molecule in these different bacteria? So we purified it, and what we found was that, unlike in those first languages that I told you about, in this case, all of the bacteria make exactly the same molecule. So this is autoinducer 2. So you care? I do. Anyway, these are carbons. So it's a very small 5-carbon molecule, right? And the real important point is that it doesn't have different flourishes, right? They all make and respond to exactly the same molecule. So this is like the bacterial Esperanto. It's the language of interspecies communication. And so now what we think is that bacteria have to, at a minimum, be built like this. They must be bilingual, in that they have to have a mechanism to know self and this mechanism to know other. And what we think bacteria do is that the first computation they do is they simply ask, am I alone or am I in a group? So they scan the environment for molecules, and that sets the beginning of this program of gene expression that says individual behaviors or group behaviors. And then the more sophisticated computation that they do is they ask, is it me or is it you? And so what we realize now is that there's a lot of sort of engineering wiring features inside here that allow them to measure the ratios of autoinducer 1 and autoinducer 2. And then they tailor what they're doing based on whether they're in the minority and you're in the majority or the reverse, right? So they do different behaviors depending on who's winning or losing in any given niche, sort of like we do. So anyway, so this is what we think is going on, and so that's where we are with this. But what I thought I would do to sort of finish this talk is to try to show you that, in fact, that we can do something practical in my lab, which is not usually my gig. But the question is whether or not, now that we know that bacteria talk to each other, can we actually deliberately manipulate that conversation and make new kinds of therapeutics? So of course, you guys know that bacteria are a globally an important problem. In countries that are not first world, you die of a microbial infection, right? Nobody lives long enough to get cancer or have a heart attack, right? It's because people die of infectious diseases. And so the question is whether or not we can actually use what we've just learned to make something, to think about new strategies for interfering with pathogens. And probably you also know, I'm sure you know, that a lot of the problem is that we have antibiotics, traditional antibiotics, that kill bacteria. So the way antibiotics work is that they make the bacterium so they can't make their membrane, they can't make DNA, they kill the bacteria. And any bacterium that fortuitously gets a mutation that makes it resistant to the drug, it and its offspring flourish. And so now we have this problem of multi-drug resistant bacteria. And so the question is whether or not you can think about this in a new way. So every antibiotic we've had kills bacteria. And so the question is, can you do behavior modification as opposed to killing them, and will that work? And so that's where we're trying to go with this. I'm not going to know the answer to that, but I'm going to tell you how we're thinking about it and how far we are along in doing that. So there's sort of two strategies that are parallel, and we and other scientists are doing both of these. So the first one is that you would like to interfere with the intraspecies communication system. So you have a patient who has cystic fibrosis, you want a drug for Pseudomonas, right? So and if that was, you know, so there's all these cases where we want species-specific, you know, bacterial-specific narrow spectrum drugs. So in that case, maybe you would target the differences in these intraspecies communication systems, right? And the other obvious strategy is if one goes to the hospital and you're sick, your physician doesn't know what's wrong with you, so you get treated with broad spectrum antibiotics while they try to hone in, you know, to figure out who's the culprit. And so in that case, maybe you'd like to go for what's common in these systems, and so try to interfere with the interspecies communication system in the hopes that you could make a anti-quorum sensing molecule that would work against all kinds of different bacteria. So the strategies to get there are the same. And so I picked this system to show you, but then you can use your imagination. It's exactly the same logic to look for an antagonist of the first system. Okay, so how do you do it? Well, of course, you guys know, we know what these molecules are. In my cartoons, they're pink ovals, but I've shown you the molecule, right? And it has a real 3D structure, right? It slots into that receptor like a lock and key. And so what one can do is to take what we know and use chemistry and simply change this molecule. So put a nitrogen in it, a sulfur, you know, add a couple of carbons. Do something to change the shape from this to something else. Right, so one by one we can go in and just use synthetic chemistry to make hundreds of different molecules that look kind of like the original molecule, and then we're going to test whether any of these jams reception of the real thing. So that's the first strategy. The other thing is that what's really been wonderful in the last couple of years is that chemists make molecules for a living. That's what chemists do. So they make molecules to figure out how chemistry works, and then they don't have anything to do with these molecules. And so the NIH has collected up all of those molecules. There's like 500,000 of them that have been made, and they all have these different shapes. And they put them into a resource for the biologists. And so what we can also do, we have access to these libraries of molecules, and we can just go and say, did any chemist, by accident, make a molecule that has this shape, right, that, you know, just fortuitously locks into our receptor. So either we make them ourselves one by one, or we try to randomly screen through molecules that exist for ones that are going to interfere with quorum sensing, right? So everybody gets that, right? So the question is, how do you get them? So now we have 500,000 plus 100 molecules to screen through. So how do you find the one or the few? You know, mostly they're duds that are duds to us, right, that are going to be anti-quorum sensing molecules. And so what we decided to do is to just go back to these Vibrio harveyi bioluminescent strains that we had made as part of our studies. And so you remember a few slides ago, I told you that we had made a bacterium that doesn't have that first language. So light turns on when this second molecule is provided, right? Remember that? So what we can do with a robot is one by one by one ask, do any of those molecules, if we add them one by one, you know, 500,000 of them one by one, shut off light in that strain, right? Thinking that that would be a molecule that interferes with the quorum sensing detection, right? So everybody gets that. So this can be done in a week with a robot, right? And so we can test these 500,000 molecules, and most of them do nothing, but a few of them, some few thousand of them, actually shut down bioluminescence. The problem with this is if I dump Clorox on this bacterium, it will also not make light, right? And so we don't want something that kills the bacterium. That's a real antibiotic. We don't want something that interferes with the light enzyme. We want something that specifically works through this receptor. So what we do is we start with these 500,000 molecules. We're down to a few thousand that shut down light, and we take those few thousand, and then we test them again. But this time, we test them on this other strain of Vibrio harveyi that we had already made. So you'll remember, we have a Vibrio harveyi that turns on light in response to only the first molecule. So if we add those few thousand one by one, what we want is a bacterium that doesn't shut off light in this context. So does everybody get that? If we were killing it, if we couldn't make DNA, both strains would die. We want ones that don't make light, if they have the receptor for autoinducer 2, but the molecule does nothing if that system is gone, right? Got it? Yes? Yes, right? So we just go back and forth, no light in this context, light in that contest, right? So then what we did, we did that, right? And what is so nice is that truly this is all done robotically. These are not what graduate students do. They have brains, and so they do more interesting things. I can't think of what those are right now, but anyway, they do more interesting things. And so in a week, we could go from this 500,000 molecules down to 1,000 that had to be tested down to 12. That's an amount that you can actually test in a real model. And so I guess I'm, well, feel free to have a nervous midlife crisis in front of you. For 20 years, I have been trying to turn on and off light in Vibrio Harveyi, and it is clear to me that no one cares whether I can do that. But I do think they care if I can do this. And so anyway, so what we do is we, you know, it doesn't matter that we can turn off light in Vibrio Harveyi. It's not a pathogen. That bacterium's never even heard of fish. We have to make these molecules so they turn off virulence in a pathogen, right? So I'm being ridiculous now, right? So, right, we went from 500,000 to 1,000 to 12, right? Right? And then we test that many is an experiment that we can really do in a model animal. So what we do then is we have a pathogenic bacterium that kills this mouse. It requires quorum sensing to kill the mouse, right? We know if we put mutants that can't talk in here, the mouse is fine. And so the question is one by one by one, 12 mice, more than 12 mice, right? Do any of those 12 molecules that we had pared down actually save this mouse, right? And the answer is two of them do. And so that's where we are right now. I want to be clear. It's very encouraging to us. These are not drugs, right? These are molecules that came out of these screens. They would kill you instantly if you took them, right? You'd have to take a pill this big, right? And it would like go immediately to your kidneys and kill you. You know, we have to, now what happens is that we have to give these molecules, they're what are called leads, to medicinal chemists, right? Who build in the features of, you know, therapeutics that you've actually taken. They have to be soluble. They have to last a long time in your body, right? They can't go to the wrong organ, right? That has not been done. But what these are, and also they're not potent enough yet, right? They're fine in this model. It's ginned up the way we do it in the lab. But now what's really good is that we do at least have these two molecules that are being moved forward so that we can think about actually trying to make them into real drugs. And it's encouraging for us to actually go back and do more experiments like this because it looks like that's a promising avenue. But that's where we are right now with that. That's where we are. And so I think what I've told you today is the bacteria talk to each other. I hope that you believe that. They don't, I see a few heads nodding. That's pretty good for me. Anyway, yeah, they don't have voices, so they talk with chemicals, right? That's their armaments or the armamentarium that they use, right? I think beyond that, what I hope you learned, right, is that bacteria are multicellular. So remember, bacteria have been on the Earth for 4 billion years. Humans have been here for a couple hundred thousand maximum, right? So this idea of groups of cells or groups of organisms working together, we think the bacteria invented that. And we hope beyond the practical part that I'm telling you is that by learning about what these molecules are, how that information gets relayed with high fidelity, by picking these apart, we're going to be able to help scientists who study higher organisms by finding some of the principles that will have been recycled in multicellular organisms and, you know, with extra bells and whistles. And we think that this is valuable just for learning about human biology as well. So that's one of our hopes as well. The other thing I hope that you saw from tonight is that bacteria can distinguish self from other. And again, I would argue that's what happens in your body all the time. It's not like your heart cells get all mixed up with your kidney cells, and that's because they use different kinds of chemicals to each of those organs to know what they're supposed to do and to do the right tasks. And again, we think bacteria invented that billions of years ago, and then you add a little more slop, you know, and you get a human being. I'm back to my version of the world, right? And then, of course, there's this very practical part, which I've given you some hints about, which is to try to develop strategies to interfere with quorum sensing. And it's not just medical, right? There's all kinds of industrial things. People are trying to make paints, you know, that hang anti-quorum sensing molecules off, plastics that could be catheters so you don't get a biofilm, all kinds of industrial applications as well. And then to actually give a plug for all the miraculous and good things that bacteria do, which is mostly what they're doing on the Earth, what we're also doing in exactly analogous strategies is to look for pro-quorum sensing molecules. So maybe the real way forward for therapeutics is to stop trying to get rid of the bad guys, but actually to enhance the conversation of the commensal bacteria that live with us all the time. We know that our commensal bacteria play an active role, hand in hand with your immune system, in getting rid of invading bacteria. We know they chit-chat like crazy, and so maybe the best thing to do is to actually just start trying to make the good guys better instead of even fighting against the bad guys. I don't know which of those strategies, if either, will work, but we're trying, and others are trying to explore both of those. And then I have to finish actually with I guess I already made a confession that I was having a midlife crisis. My second confession is that we didn't think this up. The bacteria beat us to it. So now that we understand that bacteria talk to each other, lots of colleagues of mine have been going out there and digging up dirt or looking in seawater, and sure enough, of course, the bacteria fight against each other out there. So we can find now bacteria that are out there talking. You know, one guy is talking, the guy next to it makes an enzyme that cuts the ring off that chain, so the one guy's being made mute while the other guy, you know, is taking advantage. They eat each other's molecules, they make antagonists, right? They send molecules that are information to me but deadly to you. So all of this cheating and free riding and shenanigans is out there, right? And of course, you know, it's ridiculous to think that I and a couple of chemists, you know, are going to spend a decade trying to make a molecule that's better. Like, maybe what we really ought to do is to just look out there, because the ones that actually are there on Earth have been tested over 4 billion years. They're the winners, right? And so lots of people in my field are sort of stopping to do this chemistry part and really just surveying what's out there and trying to get strategies that actually don't need much tinkering once you get them. And so that's where we are. And then I just want to show you, this is my group at Princeton. So except for the really old stuff, every experiment, every molecule I told you about was discovered by somebody who's in that picture, right? And I just want to finish by saying it's really fun for me to get to come here, but that, you know, whenever you hear something like totally goofy or new, you know, about the natural world or about technology, it was done by somebody who's under 30 years old, right? And so like, I think that we all suffer from this stereotype, you know, that scientists are old, nerdy guys, you know, but the truth is that the enterprise of science is the young people, right? And so I just want you to know that those are the people that thought up every thought that I told you and that made all of the discoveries. And so I'm really proud of that gang, because, you know, they sort of changing the way I and other people think about bacteria. And then I'll finish with this. I'm from New York, so this was our Christmas card this year that we made. That's supposed to be New York City made out of glow-in-the-dark peachy plates. So anyway, yeah. So go to New York. No, yeah. So anyway, yeah, we goof around a lot. Anyway, but thank you, David, for having me, and Boris. It's really fun, and thank you guys for coming.
Okay, so now for our usual questions. So I have one question to start with.
Chair's prerogative.
Right.
Yeah.
Which maybe you answered at the end, which was, I couldn't see the advantage of, say, I'm a bacteria, for me to talk interspecies.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems to me that I could listen, but I shouldn't talk.
Yeah, I agree.
Somebody might notice. So why does that exist at all?
Right, and so so I think that, so what I didn't show you was the pathway to make that molecule. It turns out it's a very ancient molecule, and it's made from the central metabolites that we use, all of us, to stay alive. And so what is very clear was that that was just a byproduct of having to do these reactions. So it is part of the reactions. It's a byproduct of the reactions that allow bacteria to make DNA, RNA, and proteins, which they can't get without. And so I think billions of years ago, it was just this byproduct. It was released, you know, because it was just leftovers. You know, you saw it's really simple, right? And then bacteria evolved to tune into it, right? And so you're right. There's lots of bacteria that take it back up, right? So I think, and it's niche specific. So sometimes bacteria have to cooperate. And I don't want this to be altruism. It's not altruism. Like on your teeth, you know, every morning you have those. It's always nice to have me right before the cookies. You have those sweaters on your teeth, right? There are 600 species of bacteria on your teeth every morning in exactly the same arrangement. Like New York City, right? The car mechanic, the grocer, right? You brush them off, and when you get there tomorrow, they're in exactly the same order. But it turns out that only the first few can actually metabolize the goodies. They need the guy next to them to do job B and C, right? So there's sometimes when you do have to
talk to each other because the consortium is what flourishes. Other times, in very competitive niches, they are going to all kinds of trouble to take that molecule back, right, or put extra out to make somebody else miscount. And so I think it, you know, that they have tuned into it and sort of tailored it differently depending on where they live. But I agree, there's that they wish they, it started not as a signal. Mm-hmm. That's what we're thinking.
Okay. There's one in the back there.
Yeah, if you'll indulge me, I have two quick questions, I think, regarding pathogenic biofilms. The first is it possible to provoke a mutation or a synthetic autoinducer that would cause the biofilm to disperse?
That'd be good.
And the second question is, in the context of like putting in an artificial knee or some type of prosthetic device, is there something that could promote the development of a non-pathogenic biofilm that might lay on the surface and prevent a pathogenic biofilm from taking root?
Right, those are fabulous ideas, neither done yet. Right, biofilms are the key to what the clinics are struggling with. Right, the bacteria are not just floating around in you, they're adhered to surfaces, right? And so the answer to your first question is, could you make, people are totally, I don't think that the autoinducers are gonna disrupt the biofilm. They make the biofilm unable to flourish, unable to keep growing and spread, but people are looking at the components of the outside of the biofilm, the goop of this biofilm, to actually try to find molecules that disrupt it. So that is, that's all the rage in my field. It's not, we don't think those are the anti-quorum sensing molecules. They're gonna be anti, you know, adhesion molecules. So that's being looked at. And then this business of, could you get like an artificial knee that gets covered in a commensal bacteria as, you know, and then takes the space of a pathogen. So that, those kinds of things for all of your body, people are trying to work on. What is a pity, right, is that, you know, remember at the beginning of my talk, we never understood these bacteria were there. We never understood they did all these good things for us. We never understood that they took up all the places where invaders try to come. And so what we understand about our commensal microflora is very little. You know, we only got a list of some of the bacteria a couple of years ago. We don't have genetic strategies. We don't know what each of their jobs is. But I think the field is moving. You know, people only thought the pathogens were important, and now we get that the commensals are incredibly important. And so the answer to your question, again, is it's not done, but people are trying really hard to understand, like I told you in incredible detail about these bacteria, what are those good bacteria doing so that we can exploit them and get them where we want. But it's not done yet. Those are both great ideas.
So I'm really curious, if I understand you correctly, about what seems to be the binary nature of the bioluminescence. So I understand the individual molecules, but somehow these bacteria seem to count, and there's some accumulation of a total that gets them then all turn on. So do you understand the chemistry that gets them to count up to some certain number, and what then triggers the chemistry of actually doing bioluminescence?
So yes, so we do. So they are measuring the threshold concentration of that molecule. So we can trick them. So if we have them and they're really dilute and we squirt the molecule on, they'll turn on, right? So they really believe, that when that molecule builds to this level, it's just about the affinity of the molecule for that receptor, right? And so what happens is the molecule's bouncing around and occasionally a receptor will find one, but very infrequently until the molecule builds to a certain level and then the receptor has a chance of finding one of those molecules, and then there's a chemical reaction that happens inside the cells. When that binding event happens, there's a chemical reaction that's sent into the cells that turns the genes on, right? And so it's sort of like, you know, it's like, you know, it's like these little antennas that are out there, and then, you know, only, and they're actually, there's noise filters to make sure that they get two hits so that they don't, you know, if some molecule floats by that looks kind of like the real one, you don't want the whole population to change. So there's all kinds of things, just like in engineering and in telecommunications here, those are engineered, except that everything's not in a wire, it's sloshing around in liquid, it's amazing it works, right? But it really is very much like how information processing happens in a computer, you know, with things bumping in and then relaying the messages.
You've talked about kind of jamming the communication between two bacteria species, but I was wondering if there was any way that you could turn off the signal production altogether.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So there's sort of, one is if you could never make the signal, that's fine. If you can't receive the signal, that's fine. And if you actually could do both those things, but we could slurp the signal out, that would also be fine. And so we're trying all three of those strategies. I just showed one. There, it is intrinsically easier for us to do the jamming, because to turn off the production of the molecule, you have to get your molecule inside the cell. And that is hard, right? And so people do it. I mean, antibiotics that you take get inside. But bacteria are loaded with pumps to pump out. That's why they're antibiotic resistant. Those are all pumps to pump out molecules they don't want in, right? And so we're trying that. It's just harder. It's just harder to get molecules in. But it would be a fantastic strategy. We just don't have that molecule yet.
Wonderful talk.
Thanks. I had a ball, if that matters.
my question, I guess, is related to what the guy in the back asked earlier about biofilms. If you jam the receptor for the autoinducer, why doesn't that break up the biofilms?
Yeah, you're right. So I guess you guys, so if I jam the, when a biofilm is formed, right, what happens is the biofilms form, and then the cells detect when they've sort of used up all the goodies, and then they let some go, and then they make the next biofilm, right? It's kind of like metastasis, right? And so we think once they're formed, right, and there, if we added this molecule from the outside, it wouldn't break up the existing one, but it would stop them from being able to talk and start the next one.
Oh, right? Okay. But the problem is, it could just stay there forever.
But they can't. But they actually sort of start to die in these, because they run out of oxygen, they run out of nutrients. You're right. There's real issues about whether this can work, right? But the idea also is that we would, this is fantasy, give it in conjunction with a traditional antibiotic or with one of these, if somebody could make one of these anti-biofilms, so if you could give a cocktail, you know, kick them in one knee and kick them in the other. We're also looking into that, right?
I see. But no direct clue about how to break up the biofilm.
Not yet. There's a few molecules that are at, I should say, not, this is not our work. These are friends at Harvard, Losick and Richard Losick has molecules that look like us in a test tube. Like if you add these, the biofilm gets kind of flimsy. And so those look very interesting. It's really new. It's really exciting. Yeah, it'd be great.
So I think one of the things that we're going to be thinking about for days is the model of using communications here at the very basic level. And then jumping ahead to understand how cells in an advanced system talk to each other and why. Can you give us a little more thinking about that, the analogy and the evolution?
I could try. You know, you guys have hormone receptors, right? You know, you do all this chemistry in your body. And what we know, and this gets back to your question, right, is that the molecules that I showed you, those didn't make it through evolution. So we can look in the genome. You don't have Luxes. So that molecule, you know we don't use that molecule for our cells to communicate, right? But when you look at sort of the principles, like what these receptors look like, how they span the membrane, and actually what happens is when the molecule slots in, there's a reaction called a phosphorylation cascade, where a little chemical goes down a chain and then tells genes to turn on. It is identical. The chemistry is identical to what happens in receptors in higher organisms. So even though the features are slightly different, the principles are conserved. You know, like for example, they have feedback loops, right? Like if I want to pay a lot of attention to this molecule, once my receptor starts to see it, one of the things that happens is that I make more of the receptor. It's like I really start going like this. That happens, we see that all over in eukaryotic signaling systems, right? And so these sorts of, the sort of, just the mechanisms are conserved and recycled through evolution because they work. And so it's pretty clear right? That part is the same. What's interesting that we're trying to find now with this is like, who are the molecular police, right? Like if I was gonna design this, I would make the molecule, but I would never turn on the 100 genes. You know, that's what costs. You know, I have you do it, right? You know, and so once we try to understand how, so the thing we don't understand even in these guys is how collective processes don't get invaded by cheaters, right? And I think once we find that out, that'll be interesting for thinking about how, you know, other collective processes, social behaviors work as well. You know, so there's lots of things still to find, but the sort of rudimentary part of it, it's identical. You know, it's sort of like what's true in a bacterium is, you know, is true all the way up in many, many cases, and that's pretty clear in this. Yeah.
Does any of the signaling result in a speeding up of bacterial reproduction, and therefore, like in things like sepsis, where this goes rampant?
Yeah. So the answer so far, and you know, of course, we haven't studied all bacteria, is that this is not about growth; it's about behavior. And so we can dump, you know, a bucket of these molecules on our cells, and they don't grow faster; they just change what they're doing, right? And so, as far as we can tell, they don't actually impinge on growth. It's all what repertoire genes I'm going to turn on, based, you know, I'm going solo or I'm not going solo. So that's good.
But at some point it had selective value, so it must have.
Oh, I believe it. Oh, yeah, no, I believe that, absolutely, I believe in evolution, that it had selective value in that they're not growing faster, but they are making more progeny. So if you work in the group and you and your kin or whatever, you know, get to the top of that biofilm, I think that doing the collective, right, and the evolutionary biologists that study social behavior are very interested to understand what the selective pressure was to make that happen. I mean, you know, like when you think back, you know, I always think like, you know, it's obvious, you know, like of course if you're going to secrete something, you want your neighbor to help, but it's not clear how that got here, right? You know, somebody had to start that. Yeah, so anyway.
Is there selective pressure to kill the host?
Okay, so I'm glad of all these questions. So the question is why, if you're a pathogen, why do you kill the host, right? That's your food source. And so I think I don't think bacteria, and this is my opinion, ever mean to kill the host, right? What happens, and this is very clear, the NIH and the World Health Organization do studies on this, is that when we get infected by some pathogen you've never heard about, E. coli 0157, for example, right? What's happened is that, or Lyme disease, is that technology or travel or has changed or the environment has changed, and we come smack as a virgin population, you know, in contact with some bacterium that's been here for billions of years. And it has all these bells and whistles that it's probably using to infect a yeast or to make, you know, solubilize stuff in the dirt. It unleashes them on us and we get killed. But over time, our immune system ramps up and they tone it down and they would love to be our commensals. And so it's sort of like, you know, like, so what I think is that the bacteria you're reading about in the New York Times, San Francisco Chronicle, today, you guys, whatever, right, are not going to be the ones you're going to read about 100 years from now, right? You know, like, it's like when the Europeans came here, 90 million Native Americans died. You know, we didn't get these diseases, but they did. And so that's sort of the struggle. They'll be the ones 100 years from, I will never be jobless, right? But I think that, like, you're not going to hear about, you know, E. coli 0157 is a totally great example, you know, like, if that lives in the grass, a cow eats it, the farmer and his family eat the cow, and then they croak, right? But now it's in 1,000 hamburgers, you know, all over. Yeah, and so it's very clear that that's about technology and travel. So
yeah. Disease is simply a disease.
Yeah.
So I have a question about the commensal bacteria that live in the gut, and this may be a little bit woo-woo from a science standpoint, but we all read about it a year or two ago how somebody had decided that whether you got fat or not had at least something to do with the balance of different bacteria in the gut. And I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about the signals clearly are received, and I'm an endocrinologist, so I am interested in how these signals are actually potentially perceived by eukaryotes. I'm wondering if some of the signals that the bacteria are using to speak to each other are actually signals that we can in fact.
Right. So is this a dialogue instead of a monologue, right? And so that we're absolutely looking for inter-kingdom communication, right? You know, I think, okay, intraspecies, you know. And so in fact, we have a mouse model set up with a commensal bacteria to ask, how do your immune cells react? So we can just look at all the genes turning on and off, right, with the technology. How do your immune or your epithelial cells, the one that lines your gut, react when you put this bacterium in versus that a pathogen, right? And likewise, what are the bacteria doing when they encounter a host cell? And I think, you know, like with this guy, right, you know, we swished it around in a flask and we got the molecules that are about living as a bacterium with no host around. And so now we in the whole field is trying to up this a level. And so, of course, but I'm brainwashed. I absolutely believe that there's going to be all of this communication, because it's very clear that your immune system keeps the good ones and gets rid of the bad ones, right? And so that's where I don't have evidence. That's the experiment we're trying to do. Lots of people trying to do it, right? I think you're going to hear about that in the next 5 to 10 years. And then the answer, just to go back to the thing about whether you tend to be obese, that's very clear, right? Like, so I have all these friends that believe whether you're happy or sad or you get cancer or obese, you know, it's all about your microflora, has nothing to do with you, right? And so, and what's cool is you do inherit it from your mother, right? I mean, you know, so it's just like your genes, you get this microflora, you're from your mother, and mine and my sisters and brothers are very close, and that's, but what is really becoming clear is that many of these traits, like colitis, obesity, right, that there are these real microbial components to that. Right? And so I don't think it's totally crazy anymore to think about, you know, like I of course think, you know, like the bacteria are just using us. I think I'm such a wonderful individual and I'm so charming, but that's just my bacterium trying to get me friends, and, you know, so that I'll, you know, stay, right? That this is like, you know, and so I don't think that's so kooky anymore. You know, so. What else?
Are there any more bacteria that want to speak up?
Yeah. Oh, thanks.
Thanks, John. There are refreshments in the common room for those of you who want to feed your
bacteria.